Micah chapter 6, verses 1 through 8. Listen to what the Lord says. Stand up, plead my case before the mountains. Let the hills hear what you have to say. Hear, you mountains, the Lord's accusation. Listen, you everlasting foundations of the earth. For the Lord has a case against his people. He is lodging a charge against Israel. My people, what have I done to you? How have I burdened you? Answer me. I brought you up out of Egypt and redeemed you from the land of slavery. I sent Moses to lead you, also Aaron and Miriam. My people, remember what Balak, king of Moab, plotted, and what Balaam, son of Beor, answered. Remember your journey from Shittim to Gilgal, that you may know the righteous acts of the Lord. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow down before the exalted God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams and ten thousands of rivers of oil? Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has shown you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. This is the word of God for the people of God. So, how many of you have to take prescriptions? Wow. A lot of us that do, okay? So we get everything from the cough syrup to the pills to the injectables. Those two bottom ones are mine, the pills and the injectables. Why do we take this stuff? You can talk in church. To maintain health, exactly. So if you have high blood pressure, there's a pill for that, right? If you've got stomach problems, there's pills or liquid for that. If you're a diabetic like I am and pills don't cut it, you got insulin that you take to supplement what your pancreas is not producing. We do all of these for a good, hopefully healthy life and for longevity. Well, God is also concerned about our spiritual lives, not just our physical, but also our spiritual. And so here in Micah, he gives us a prescription so that we might live a healthy, godly life. So that's what we're going to look at this morning from this passage in Micah. First of all, just a little bit of background about Micah. He was a prophet who prophesied somewhere probably between 750 and 700 BC. He was prophesying at the same time as Isaiah was. So if you read the book of Isaiah and you read the book of Micah, they're prophesying at about the same time. First chapter of Micah tells us that he prophesied during the reigns of Jotham and Ahaz and Hezekiah. So that kind of fits into this time frame in the 700s BC. In Israel at this time, economically, it was a very prosperous time. Things were going well. They had money. They had jobs. It was all good. Except spiritually, it was not good. It was a very, very low time spiritually for Israel and particularly for Judah because Micah was prophesying primarily toward Judah during this time. And so he is prophesying throughout this book, telling them that God is wearing thin on his patience. He has been extremely patient with the people for years and years and years with their sin, their rebellion, their turning against the law, their flaunting everything that God has given them. And Micah is writing to warn them that God's judgment is coming and they need to be prepared for it. So we find that court is in session in verses 1 and 2 because God calls the hills, the mountains, and the foundations of the earth to listen up. Does this sound at all familiar? Were any of you here last week? Did you listen to Pastor David's sermon last week? What did he say about Isaiah chapter 1? Yeah, what is this? Yes, it is court, all right? God is calling the court into session. When he calls on the hills and the mountains and the foundations of the earth to listen up, he's calling court into session. So just like we saw last week in Isaiah chapter 1, God's doing the same here in Micah chapter 6. He's calling court into session because he has a bone to pick with his people. He is bringing a case against the people because they have forsaken him and they have forsaken the law. And so he is going to call this court together in order to give them an opportunity to present their case. He is going to present his case, and he's calling on creation, which has been here before the people were, and would actually be a very good jury to hear what's going on because they're kind of impartial. And the hills, the mountains, the foundations of the earth have seen and heard everything that has gone on from the very beginning. So in verse 3 and through verse 5, God begins to make his case. He wants the people to tell him why. What is your rationale for leaving me? Why have you gone astray? Why have you forsaken my law? Why are you oppressing your brothers and sisters? Why are you doing all of these things that I commanded you not to do? And he asked them two questions. What have I done to you? And how have I burdened you? Now, a lot of you are in relationships. Most of you are in marriage relationships. If your husband or your wife suddenly kind of goes silent on you, and they just not talking like they usually do, what do you do? You just be silent back? Or do you try to find out what's going on? David, okay. You know, if my wife is kind of acting a little different, what did I do? What did I say? What's gotten you upset? Let's talk about it. Okay? So God is coming to the people. He's saying, I'm upset with you. I want to know why. Answer me. Give me an answer. What is going on here? Now imagine yourself that you're in the courtroom. The people are there. God's there. And he asked these questions. Do you hear a silence? What have I done to you? How have I burdened you? And the people are just kind of, Okay, you don't want to talk? I'll talk, God says. And so he goes and gives us a little history lesson. He reminds the people of four acts of love that he has done for the people and wonders why, after he's done all of this, that they have turned their backs on him. The first thing that he mentions here is, I brought you up out of Egypt and redeemed you from the land of slavery. Now, Israel always traces its history back to the Exodus. That's when they became a nation. It wasn't just a people who were related to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They had grown, multiplied in numbers during their captivity in Egypt. And when they came out of Egypt, they were probably better than a million strong. Okay, so there was a lot of people. But this is the time that they always go back to as to when their nation was birthed. It was when God delivered them from bondage in Egypt. And over again in that Exodus, God had shown his mighty power to the people. First of all, it was with the plagues. You remember after Moses and Aaron came back, and they went to Pharaoh and said, God says, let my people go. And he refused and refused and refused and refused. And God sent these terrible plagues on the people. You read through it in the book of Exodus. You know, the magicians, they could do maybe the first two or three, but after that, God says, nah, you're done. I'm going to do stuff that you can't do. And he just peppered them, pounded them with these plagues. And the people saw. And eventually, there was even a distinction between what was happening to the Egyptians and what was happening to the Israelites. Because the Israelites were not suffering the plagues anymore. It was only the Egyptians. God was demonstrating his power. He says, I've shown you my love. Right? Then he says, I did this also in the Passover, that tenth plague. I told you to kill a lamb, roast its meat, and sprinkle the blood on the doorpost. I'm going to send the death angel through. And when I see the blood on the doorpost, my death angel will pass over that house so that you will not experience the death of your firstborn. The people saw that. People in Israel didn't suffer the death of their firstborn at all, but the Egyptians were crying out because in every household, at least one person was dead. They saw the power of God. And then as they leave, they ask the people for gold and silver and brass and iron and cloth and all of this kind of stuff. And the Egyptians, take it, get out of here, just go, okay? Take it with you. And they leave, and they come to the Red Sea. And the Egyptians had a kind of a change of mind. What do we let these people go? So the people cry out to God, what are we going to do? The Egyptians are behind us, the water's in front of us. What did God do? Parted the waters. People went through on dry ground. The Egyptians came in after them. Waters came back and drowned the enemies. God's power was demonstrated over and over again. And he was with them constantly in the pillar of cloud or the pillar of fire. He was there to protect them. He was there to help them. And you hear God saying, what have I done to you? How have I burdened you? I delivered you from your bondage in Egypt. And number two, he says, I sent you Moses and Aaron and Miriam. I didn't leave you out there all by yourself. I sent Moses to lead you. I sent Moses to teach you my laws so that you wouldn't have to wonder what you ought to be doing. You wouldn't have to wonder if I was with you. I was with Moses, and he was there with you. I sent Aaron, the priest, to intercede for you. He is the one who accepted your sacrifices. He is the one who prayed for you. He was the one who stood between you, sinful people, and me, a holy God. I've been with you. I sent Miriam. Miriam was a prophetess. She prophesied many times that we read in the Torah. My voice has always been with you. I've not left you alone. I spoke to Moses, and Moses spoke to you. I spoke to Aaron, and Aaron spoke to you. I spoke through Miriam to you. What have I done to you? How have I burdened you? I have blessed you, and I have been with you all of these years. Number three, he says, I protected you from Balak. Do you remember this story in Numbers 22 to 24? Balak was the Moabite king. That'd be on the east side of the Jordan River. East, that's your west, east. East side of the Jordan River, okay? And he saw this horde of people coming. So he sent some emissaries to Balaam, who was a prophet. He says, come curse these people so they don't destroy me. Because they'd already destroyed Og and, what was the other guy's name? Og, king of Bashan, and I forget what the other guy's name. But anyway, destroyed two kings. And Balak says, come prophesy against these people. Curse them so that they won't be able to overwhelm me. So Balaam goes to God. God says, nope, don't go with them. Okay. They go back to Balak. Balak says, he's got to come. I'm going to send higher ranking people. I'm going to send greater gifts. You go back and you tell him he needs to come curse these people. So they go back a second time. What's Balaam do? Hey, God, yeah, I know you said I shouldn't go, but you know, these guys are here again. Maybe, oh, why can't I go? And God says, okay, if you want to go, you can go. But you can only speak what I tell you to speak. So you remember the story how he went? They came to that narrow place in the road, and they met the angel of the Lord, and the donkey sat down. And he beat the donkey, and then what did the donkey do? He talked to him. Yeah. What are you beating me for? Don't you see that angel up there? I can't go any further. Can you imagine talking to a donkey? You know, about the only way you talk to a donkey is with a tuba for. No, okay? So Balaam talks to a donkey, and God lets him go. But what's he do? Four different times up on the mountain from different perspectives, Balak has him go. Offers all these sacrifices, and what can Balaam do? He blesses the people of Israel over and over and over again. God says, don't you see what I've done for you? Okay? How have I burdened you? I protected you when you didn't even know it. There's a guy who's trying to curse you. And I wouldn't let him because you're my people and I love you. Fourthly, it says, remember your journey from Shittim to Gilgal. Shittim was the last encampment that the Israelites had on the east side of the Jordan. Gilgal was the first encampment they had on the west side of the Jordan. So what God is doing here, he's telling them to remember what happened between Shittim and Gilgal. Because there's some things that took place here, we find in Numbers chapter 25 and following. In Numbers chapter 25, we find that the people of Israel began to worship Baal. And they began to commit immorality with the Moabites. Here they had been 40 years in the desert. God's presence had been with them. God's provisions had been made available to them. They had manna every day. They had quail. They had everything that they needed. Even when they cried out for water, God brought water from a rock. Even when Moses disobeyed, God had been faithful. God had kept his people through the wilderness for these 40 years, teaching them the law. And here they go, a whoring after a strange people. So Moses commanded that those who had committed these acts be killed. And the leaders of Israel began going through the community and slaying those who had disobeyed God's law. There was one guy who was a leader named Zimri, who in broad daylight, not under the cloak of darkness, but in broad daylight, brought a Midianite woman into his tent. You imagine that? This is how depraved these people had gotten over 40 years. Even though God had been faithful to be with them, to provide for them, to protect them, to give them victory, all of this, and this is what they do with God's love and God's provision. When Phinehas the priest saw Zimri and this woman go into the tent, he ran with a spear and he thrust it through both of them and killed them. And the scriptures tell us at that moment the plague of God was stopped, but not before 24,000 people had died that day. This is at Shittim. The people had forsaken God. They had done things that were absolutely abhorrent. So, you ever wonder why they did this? You know you have to go to the book of Revelation to find out. To the letter in Pergamum, there are some among you who hold to the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to entice the Israelites to sin so that they ate food sacrificed to idols and committed sexual immorality. God wouldn't let Balaam have the riches that Balak wanted to give him. But Balaam underhandedly went to Balak and he says, if you really want these people to be defeated, get your people to cozy up to those people. Have them invite the Israelites to their worship services. Have them start to intermingle with the people of God. Let them start doing immoral things with one another and offering their children to Baal and all of that stuff. And he says, then you will see that God will withdraw his hand and you'll have victory over these people. It was this guy that taught Balak how to get to the Israelites. Well, it wasn't all bad because after that got cleared up, Joshua sent some spies over into the promised land. Remember, they went to Jericho. Rahab met them. And they were able to discover that the people were absolutely afraid of the Israelites. They were terrified. You remember how Rahab hid them on the roof of her house? When they came to find them, they couldn't. She let them go with the promise that if she kept the scarlet cord out of her window when the Israelites came to destroy the city, she and her family would be saved. And then, what else did God do? They come to the Jordan River. Joshua tells the priests, step your feet in the water with the ark. And when they do, the water goes, whoosh, it parts. And the people went over on dry ground to the land that God had promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and their descendants forever. So, can you hear the voice of God echoing in the silence? What have I done to you? How have I burdened you? Answer me. God's laid out his case, and I can just still hear the people kind of going, Finally, they get up some courage to rebut. Have you ever noticed when you ask people a direct question and they don't want to answer it, they try to change the subject? You ever done that? You ever read John 4? Jesus is with the Samaritan woman. Go call your husband. I don't have one. Yeah, I know. You've had five, and the guy you're living with isn't your husband. Well, you Jews think that we should worship in Jerusalem. Okay? She just changed the subject. When we were down at Harvey Cedars a couple weeks ago for our vacation, one of the speakers was actually from Maine. He lives in Newport. And he was saying that one time he was conducting a funeral service, and after the service, he rode in the hearse with the funeral director to the cemetery to do the committal. And he asked the driver, he said, where are you going when it's your turn to be back there instead of up here? And he said, the guy said, you know, I've noticed that your funeral sermons are a lot different than most of the other pastors. He just changed the subject. He didn't want to answer the question. Well, this is what the Israelites kind of do here, okay? So in verses 6 and 7, here's what they say. With what shall I come before the Lord? How shall I bow down before him? Will he be satisfied with sacrifices of year-old calves? Or maybe I should do thousands of rams or 10,000 of rivers of oil? Or will God be pleased if I give the firstborn of my flesh to him as a sacrifice for my sins? Do you see what's going on here? Okay? Do you see that there's a little bit of hyperbolic intensity that's happening here? You know what hyperbole is, right? Extreme exaggeration. Okay? So the sacrifices of yearling calves, that would be something normal. God prescribed that in the law. But now we're talking about thousands of rams. Rams were an acceptable sacrifice. You can read that in the law, too. By the way, I've been going through the law in my devotional time. Boy, Leviticus is a hard book to get through. I'm glad I'm done with that. I'm into Numbers now, but every time I read Leviticus, I am so grateful that I live in an age of grace and not the age of law. Because I'd be spending all my time at the temple. Okay, just saying. Thousands of rams would be okay. Was oil an acceptable sacrifice to God? That too was prescribed in the law, okay? But we're talking now about 10,000 of rivers of oil, all right? Not just a hin or a gera or whatever it was. You know, not a quart or a gallon. We're talking about 10,000 rivers. And then to suggest something that God had absolutely forbidden, that they were never, ever, ever to offer their children in sacrifice to an idol. Ever. The firstborn was to be redeemed with an animal. They were not to be killed. This to me is kind of shocking, this kind of response, which causes me to ask a question. Do you think that their questions were sincere, or do you think that they were cynical? How many think they were sincere? How many think they were cynical? Yeah, I agree with you. I think they're very, very cynical. It's like, oh, they're having a little bit of a temper tantrum here. And they're starting to say things like this to God. Oh, you're too restrictive. You won't let me have any fun. You demand too much. What do you want? Thousands of rams and 10,000 rivers of oil? What's going to satisfy you, giving my child up in sacrifice to you? Your laws are too hard to follow. I can't live the way I want to. You're just mean. I'm bored. Does this sound like anything that you've experienced? You ever have a teenager talk like that to you? Okay. Honesty. Thank you, Ellen. I think we've all done this at one time or another. Yeah, the people are just acting like spoiled brats. Except it's not innocent stuff that we're dealing with here. This is life and death. This is dealing with God. This is all a matter of obedience to Him and to what He says. And so God in His patience gives them a prescription in verse 8. He says basically, I don't want your stuff. I don't want your year-old calves. I don't want your thousands of rams. I don't want your 10,000s of rivers of oil. I don't want your firstborn. Here's what I want. I want you. I want you. And here's the way you can show me that I have you. Act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. What's it mean to act justly? In this context, the people in this time of prosperity were actually oppressing the poor among them. And they were using, and you'll find this through the prophets a lot of times, they were using dishonest scales, dishonest weights. It was like they would have a 12-ounce weight and tell everybody that it was a pound. And they would be selling 12 ounces for the price of a pound. Okay? It was that type of thing. They were just cheating people left, right, and center. These people were doing all kinds of things that the law had forbidden. Charging interest on loans, forcing their brothers into slave labor, withholding wages, giving false testimony, perverting the justice system, failing to observe the year of Jubilee. Do you remember about the year of Jubilee? Every 50th year, everything was supposed to revert to its original state. If a person had sold a piece of land because they were poor and they needed the money, in the year of Jubilee, that land went back to them. If they had hired themselves out because they were poor and couldn't make it on their own, in the year of Jubilee, they were set free to go back to their own land and to their own family. Every 50 years, this was supposed to take place. This hadn't happened for hundreds of years at this point. And you still, you know, it kind of explains a little bit as to why there was such a disparity. There were people who were doing extremely well and people who had nothing. Jubilee had not happened for a long period of time. He's telling the people, you are acting unjustly toward your own kin, toward people of your own family. You need to stop that. If you want to experience my blessing, you need to act justly toward others. He says, I didn't treat you that way. I didn't withhold anything from you, in spite of your rebellion, in spite of your walking away from me and from my laws, I have still continued to pour out my blessing upon you. I have acted justly toward you in keeping my covenant promise with you. You have been unfaithful. But if you want to know what is right to do and to be a proper, godly person, act justly toward those around you. Secondly, he says, love mercy. Mercy means loving kindness. And it usually has to do with forgiveness. The Hebrew word here is hesed. And I don't know if any of you have studied that particular word. It's a very complicated word. But the idea behind it is that there is a principle, a characteristic of love behind what is happening. And as mercy is portrayed here, this is the word that's used in Micah, it is the loving kindness, the mercy, the forgiveness of God that is based in his love. It's not something that he necessarily has to do, but he does it because it's his nature and his character to do that. Right? Is that understandable? My simple definition of mercy is not getting what we deserve. Right? If we got what we deserve, we would all get hell. Because we're all sinners and we've all transgress God's law. But because of God's mercy, his loving kindness, his forgiveness, we don't have to experience that. But rather, we can experience the eternal life that he has promised through Jesus Christ our Lord. God has reminded the people that he has been merciful to them for hundreds of years. They have been rebellious from the time they came out of Egypt. And there have been high points along the way where they've been really faithful to God. And there have been a lot of low points along the way where they have been totally unfaithful to God. And at this point in Micah's prophecy, they are at one of those low points. Micah is basically telling us here what Jesus did too, that if we have received mercy, we also ought to be extending mercy to others around us. You remember the parable Jesus told about the servant that was called in, and he owed his master like a couple $1 million, and he begged for mercy, and the master forgave him. And then that servant went out and found another servant that owed him a couple $100 and choked him, and he begged for mercy, and he had him thrown in jail. Okay? Jesus' last words on that were that if you don't forgive your brother who has sinned against you, neither will my Father in heaven forgive you. Right? If God has been merciful to us, we also need to be merciful to others. This is my dad and my son. Most of you know Chad. At this time, this was 5 years ago. It was my dad's last trip to Maine before he passed away. And he liked to go up and visit Chad. He liked to go out in the patrol car. He'd always come back and say, "Man, you ought to see him whip that thing around, you know, and go chasing after." He loved that. I mean, he's 87 years old, you know, 86 at this point. Yeah, okay. So they're out on the airline one day, Route 9 up in Washington County. And this truck is coming along doing 79 miles an hour in a 55. So what's Chad do? Of course, he turns on him, pulls him over. He goes up to him, he gets his registration, his license, insurance, all that stuff. He comes back to the car. And Chad says to Pop-Up, "What do you think I ought to do? Should I give him a ticket? Should I let him go?" And my dad said, "Well, today, why don't you just give him a warning and let him go?" Chad said, "Are you sure?" He says, "Yeah." He said, "Well, you just give him a warning today." "Okay." So Chad wrote out a written warning. He went back up to the driver and he says, "I want you to know the only reason you're not getting a ticket today is because my grandfather. Because I went back and asked him what I should do, and he says I should let you go today. So you're receiving mercy. You deserve a ticket, but I'm not going to give you a ticket today." Chad said that guy had a pretty big smile on his face when he left the cab. Okay, that's mercy. Not getting what we deserve. We have received a lot of mercy from God, and if we're going to act in a godly way, we need to be those who are merciful to others. Thirdly, he says, walk humbly with your God. Humble here means to be modest, to be lowly. The people in Israel at this time in Micah's day were not modest and lowly. They were arrogant, they were proud, they were self-seeking. They were doing everything that was contrary to what they were supposed to be doing for God. We need to understand that in our walk with God, there is absolutely no room for pride. It rears up its ugly head in our lives, all of us, in very, very different ways. And sometimes it's ways that we don't think are prideful, but the root of it is really pride. You know, if we get the back of our hair up because somebody said something nasty to us, that's probably pride. They wounded our character. You know, we don't like that, and we're going to fight back. Micah says here, God's words, walk humbly with your God. Proverbs tells us that pride goes before a destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. I've seen that worked out not too long ago, about a year ago. It's true. God does not like prideful people. And on these Israelites, he is about to send his judgment because of their pride and their arrogance and their thinking that they don't need him. James tells us in James 4:10 that we need to humble ourselves before the Lord, and he will lift us up. In these things that Micah has spoken, does any of this sound familiar in another context? Anybody want to hazard a statement here? Does this sound familiar at all? Can I give you a hint? Teacher, they asked, what is the greatest commandment in the law? Jesus replied, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. Walk humbly with your God. Does that kind of sound like love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind? To do justly and love mercy, does that kind of sound like loving your neighbor as yourself? See, the world's philosophy is do others before they do you. The Bible philosophy is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. See the continuity here between the Old Testament and the New? It's saying the same thing. So how can we live godly lives? If you were here last week, you know that we live in a broken world. The world system is broken. We are broken. And everything we do, everything we think, is broken. So how on earth can we do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with our God? Here's the solution. John chapter 6. This is after Jesus fed the 5,000. They chased him around the lake. They're looking for more food. He's telling them to do the works of God. They asked him, what must we do to do the works of God? Jesus answered, the work of God is this, to believe in the one he has sent. You see, the only way we can do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with our God is through a relationship with Jesus Christ. We cannot do this on our own. Like Pastor David said last week, we can try harder, we can grit our teeth, we can make all those determinations and resolutions and everything else, and it's nothing if we don't have Jesus. It's only because of Jesus that we are able to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God. If he's not part of the equation, it doesn't work. He's the doctor that wrote the prescription. And if we take what he has ordered, we will live godly lives pleasing to him. Let's pray. Lord, may we learn from the example of the Israelites what not to do. Deliver us from pride. Deliver us from being oppressors. Deliver us from being unjust. But may we, like Jesus, go about doing good. May we be just with one another. Not lying, not cheating, not extorting, not trying to get the upper hand, but doing what is right and honest and true. May we love mercy. As we have received so much mercy from you, may we freely extend that to others who may offend us. And then, Lord, may we walk humbly with you all the days of our lives, recognizing our total dependence upon you to live in a way that brings honor and glory to your name. We ask this in his precious name.